the crux of this thing is it's the world's cheapest shelter for doing large-scale things like refugee situations, IDPs, anything along this kind of line. Now, what I mean by world's cheapest, I mean if you build them right, in some circumstances, they will be 5% of the cost of a tent. Right? And when I say 5%, I literally mean 5%. Why? It's 12 sheets of plywood. Right? The manufacturing instructions is take your 12 sheets of plywood, cut six of them in half, put the two pieces together, put them on their sides to make the roof triangles, take six more sheets, put them flat on the side, those are your walls. So the idea behind this thing is that when you've got some kind of large-scale disaster, you take all of the guys who pour concrete for a living, and you show them this design, and you show them how to build it, and you build a few with them, and then they go and build them. And they buy the plywood in the same place that they buy all the materials for framing buildings when they're making, you know, concrete buildings, right? I mean, anywhere you see a concrete building, somebody knew how to build a plywood box to pour the concrete into, right? So, in a lot of ways, this isn't a very interesting project, because I just told you basically everything you need to know about. All the instructions are on the internet. It's taken me 8 years to get one built in a disaster environment, because if I'd started a charity and raised money to do it, if I had succeeded, none of the other charities would ever have touched it with a 1,000-foot barge pole. Right? All of the individual technologies, like biosand water filters, or particular brands of fuel-efficient stove, even if there's no copyright, no patent on the design, because they're identified as being the funding priority of one charity, none of the other charities will ever look at that technology. So you wind up with a lot of isolationism in the field and non-propagation of tech. So I ran it as an open source project with no fundraising arm to speak of, so that if we ever actually succeeded in getting word out there, any charity could use it without feeling like they were helping their competitors. And it's kind of a sad comment that the primary objective of the Hexier project was not to be a charity, because if we were a charity, we couldn't scale. You see? There's kind of a lesson in that. So with that, I want to move on to something a little broader that I think might be of direct interest to this audience. Because this is very much a disaster relief kind of thing, and most of you are not interested in disaster, you're interested in development, right? Generally speaking, development audience? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, new and development. So let me start with a real piece of wisdom, which was said to me by Fred, who's an economist in The Hague, and Fred really knows Africa. His project was a 5-bedroom steel-framed McMansion that you could build in Africa for about $30,000, and he wanted to do the middle class of the entire continent. Great idea. Does that sound like the Africa you know? Right? Okay. So 200 years ago, New World meant what developing world means today. Right? Fred looked at Africa and saw America of 1790. Now that, to me, was a real jaw-dropping insight. I mean, I looked at that and was like, whoa. And it's taken me about 2 years to really process it. The Big Five, right? You hear these talked about again and again and again and again. The reason I put stop smoking first is that stopping smoking saves more lives than any other single measure, pretty much everywhere. The next three, filtered water, smokeless cooking, effective sanitation, these are all infrastructure, and improved agriculture, education. Very, very simple, straightforward. This is worth about a quarter of all human death every year. All causes, 60 million. These five causes cause somewhere between 15 and 30 million of those deaths, depending on how you think about it. Very, very simple. So, end of aid. Nutshell version of this, the world is going bankrupt. US real unemployment rate is about 20%. Europe, everybody owes everybody else money. Nobody actually has any, apart possibly from the Germans, and we're not sure about that. China is massively dependent on Europe and specifically America for its economic development and also for its internal political stability, because they've been maintaining the sort of myths of Maoism, or Chinese socialism with Chinese characteristics, on the basis of continued economic growth. If the economic growth stops, they have to pay the democracy tax. So China is not going to be there. One way or the other, aid is over. 5 or 10 years from now, you're not going to see ring fencing of the DFID budget. You're going to see one gigantic global mess, better than 80% probability. So if you don't like aid, don't worry, it's going away. If you do like aid, panic. I mean that seriously. I mean, it's just, we're done. So let's talk about kind of an asset-based community development kind of perspective on this. What does Africa have? Tons of room, right? 1 Acre Fund, do you know these guys? You heard of them? They are probably the most important charity on the face of the planet because they've got 12,000 farms in Africa where they've demonstrated a one-year training course that doubles agricultural productivity. And, bonus points, halves infant mortality. So if you could double agricultural productivity and half infant mortality for the whole of Africa, would that basically solve the problem? I think yes. Yeah, 12,000 farms. 3 years of history, they're data-driven, they're very transparent, 1 Acre Fund, they're just, I can't tell you how important they are. Okay, phones. Selling, has anybody noticed any problems in Africa selling more phones? Growth market for phones, growth market for services. Growth, where is the potential globally for growth? Most of the world, which has developed, has basically maxed out its potential for growth. I don't think Africa's even started yet. So the inner prospect of a world which has stagnant developed economies, the developing world and growth in the developing world and access to capital to fuel that growth could be a completely different landscape. But it has to be driven by internal economics. Now, let's move on to Transnet. So, the state has not yet been revolutionized by technology. Right? The UK government, the American government, the European governments, they all work basically the same way that they did before the internet. Right? Has anybody bought a book recently? Right? Yeah, okay. How has that experience changed in the last 10 years? You read the reviews online, you might buy the thing from Amazon. The book was probably written by a bunch of different authors who somehow or other all collaborated to make it happen online. You know, there's all kinds of changes in the way that books are sold. Dating, right? Some, if you look at the stats, absurd numbers of people are meeting across Facebook or OkCupid or eHarmony or whatever and getting married. Government really just hasn't changed at all. Other aspects of life are in total flux. So my contention is that the reform of the state by technology, this massive change to what you might think of as e-government, is going to happen in Africa first. And it's going to happen in Africa first for the same reason that M-Pesa happened in Africa first. And we can discuss why M-Pesa happened in Africa first, but it did, and the same set of market forces that pushed it to happen in Africa first are likely to apply to government as well. So this is basically, I should just make a point about this. This is about disaggregation and reaggregation. Which functions are performed by what tiers of a system tell you something about the fundamentals of the system. So in Europe, we've got this governance stack, which is maybe 500 or 600 years old in fundament. And in Africa, the governance stack might look completely different. Functions that we think are core functions of the state in Europe might turn out to be private enterprise or community in Africa. Does that make sense? And that's a huge opportunity for technological innovation. So I'm going to suggest that the core question for Africa is how do you finance infrastructure? Right? I pointed at the middle three of the big five, water, cooking, sanitation. Right? To this we can also add energy for telecoms infrastructure. That infrastructure foundation, that infrastructure formation, is the core function of the European state. Right? What the Victorians did was the Victorians built gigantic sewers for 100 years, half the mortality rate in London, infant mortality rate in London, turned it into a prosperous city rather than an enormous slum. Right? And infrastructure development was seen as being a core function of the state. Right? Now that may not be the way that this works out in the long term in Africa. And the pivot around this is distributed infrastructure. Now, what that basically means is one toilet with no external dependencies, no sewage system, no trenches, no pipes, perhaps. And we know how to do that, it's a composting toilet. Power, it's a couple of solar panels on your roof rather than constructing a national power grid. Cooking, instead of your smokeless cooking being a gas main that goes off to $1 billion of build, your smokeless cooking is a stove that runs on wood that saves 5 times the efficiency of an open fire. You see? So you can change the shape of the infrastructure to fit the economic and political conditions of the environment you're operating in. And Small is Profitable was The Economist's book of the year in 2003. It's by Amory Wavin's team at Rocky Mountain Institute, and I was one of the people who helped edit it. and it's 400 pages of densely argued economic theory telling you why there's never going to be a Pan-African power grid, why it's all going to be distributed infrastructure. So my sort of contention is, if you can figure out how to do finance and infrastructure build-out using networks, you'll have solved Africa's core problem. And that doesn't necessarily require waiting around for the state to do anything. And in fact, if you're effective, the state may well get the heck out of your way and let you do it. Does this sound reasonable? Now, the place where this connects to the Hexier project is, as I discussed, the Hexier is not very interesting inherently. It's a 12-sheet plywood shack. Right? But if you put 100,000 Hexiers in a field, what will happen is that everybody will die of disease. Right? They're going to deforest everything for 50 kilometers and everybody will die of disease. This is not a success in shelter. It's not. So around individual buildings, around individual Hexiers, you need a lightweight infrastructure harness. You need a toilet. You need a stove, you need a water purifier, you might need a little solar power for light and phones if people are going to be there for a while. And that's what got me interested in decentralized infrastructure. If you can design decentralized infrastructure that will work in a refugee camp, you can design decentralized infrastructure which will work for tens or hundreds of millions of people in Africa, right? If I can make it work for $50 to $80 a household for refugees, you can make it work for $200 a household and have something that people will really look up with some kind of pride rather than as a basic survival structure. So decentralization of infrastructure is one key. Then the question is, how do you fund and how do you manage the funds? How do you project manage large-scale decentralized infrastructure rollout? If you go to the World Bank and ask them for $100 million to do 85,000 tiny projects, how are they going to look at you? Management overheads are insane. So I wrote a paper called The Global Village Development Bank, which addresses how you might look at restructuring finance around the realities of a bankrupt first world, a bankrupt developed world, and a massive need for decentralized infrastructure in the so-called developed world. Global Village Development Bank. It's only worth the look. How many minutes
have you got?
Four minutes, okay, great. So resources, just things you might want to look at. Hexer, we talked about, small profit, we talked about, dealing in security. So dealing in security is a mapping guide, which I originally created for dealing in with state failures. And it's an 18-point checklist, which basically anybody who's doing sort of development work ought to at least be familiar with, which takes you from the individual survival needs of a person to the core functions of the state. Shall I go over that very quickly? I can give you the nutshell of it. So, four tiers of cooperation: individual, group, organization, nation state. This is very high level, very abstract. So for individuals to exist, they need six things. They need not to be too hot or too cold. They need not to be hungry or thirsty. They need not to be ill or injured. And the first function of infrastructure is to protect people from those six immediate risks. So that's the infrastructure build out at the individual level. For groups to form, you need communications, you need transport, you need some kind of office space, and you need resource control to say who can use which resources. Again, very simple. But organizations need some kind of internal structure. They need a shared map of reality, and they need a plan relative to that map. And then the state needs effective organizations. It needs international recognition, a list of people. It needs a map of the land that it has control of, and it needs a legal jurisdiction. It's a very, very simple structure. Now, those 18 functions are not necessarily going to be provided by the same parts of society as they're provided by in Europe. This is the core problem with development. It assumes that Africa, fully developed, is going to look something like Europe does. And there's just no reason to assume that. There's no reason at all to assume that infrastructure financing in Europe will be done in the same way that infrastructure financing is done in America, or as it's done in Africa. And I'll give you an example of this, which is, in America, do you know they elect their sheriffs? Law enforcement, your chief of police, is an elected position for each municipality. And if you think about how that would change our perception of how London worked, if we elected the chief of police in the same way that the mayor is elected, how would that change your perception of policing? And that was one of the fundamental shifts between the way that Britain did governance and the way that America does it. So it's not that this kind of thing hasn't happened. If you think about how different America and Europe are in their perspective, at a very similar level of development, this goes back to Fred's point, right? New world then means the same as developing world now. And the possibility to look at the examples of America and the examples of Europe and the failures and correct is very real. So that's dealing with insecurity. This is a book that I'm currently doing, and this is the last thing I'm going to plug. The Future We Deserve, which is a collaborative book project about the future. And the idea is to try and get 100 people to write 100 short essays about the future in 100 days, and then bind them and produce a book. So that's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Do we have time for two or three questions?
You have 2 minutes.
2 minutes. OK, 2 minutes. Quick. Any questions? Sun silence. Good. Always good silence. Yes.
Have you found any banks that are starting to look at the funding for the distributed infrastructure?
Not at this point. Project, actually managing the projects is pretty tricky. And it's a different kind of certainty than the kind of certainty that banks are used to. Like Grameen Bank is ideally positioned to think through those issues, but I think you would have a hard time moving it through most other banking infrastructure. Yes.
And also in regards to distributed infrastructure, what's the response like from governments who still seem to be dead set on trying to recreate things like the power grid and, you know, the way municipalities work in the West versus thinking of new models for their countries?
And generally speaking, governments globally hate, fear, and loathe distributed infrastructure. Right? Everybody wants to take the solar panels and put them in gigantic arrays out in the desert and then continue to maintain the national grids. Because if you spent $1 trillion on a national grid, the idea that you don't need it because solar panels and wind work is a little bit threatening. That's basically what smallest profit rule is about. It basically says, look, if you do a cost dollar per dollar comparison between decentralized solar and wind and national grids turn out to be incredibly expensive, and you never see that never shows up in your bill as a line item. So basically, nobody likes it. That doesn't mean it's wrong. Yes.
And can you say a little bit about the Haiti connection?
Haiti. Okay.
I assume from what you said that,
yes,
that in a way you tested out some elements.
Oh, we got hexier.
The thesis.
Yeah, the thesis that we tested in Haiti was that the NGOs don't like hexierts.
Right.
I mean, you know, you've got 1.3 million people without houses, yes, and you have a housing technology which is potentially hurricane resistant and half the price of a tent. Right. I managed to get one hexier built. The charity that financed it lost its core funding and no longer has any kind of existence. The charity that built it is basically a very small group that's very well motivated. And I've talked to every single person in Shelter Cluster and a lot of brand name charities about, would you like to look at this technology and get your engineers to test it? And they've all said no. Why? Again, this thing that you could take the core function of building shelter and take it out of the hands of the NGOs, out of the hands of government, and into the hands of local builders, nobody likes it. Why? Decentralization. Decentralization is extremely politically unpopular because the core function of most of the organizations that you know of that have names is to centralize money and theoretically get efficiency from it. What Smallest Profitable is about is decentralizing money and getting the efficiency from keeping the money close to the problem. Okay? So, I mean, when I invented the Hexier in 2002, I said this is a paradigm shift. Paradigm shifts take 15 years. So I expected the first large-scale Hexier deployment to be done in 2017. We are halfway there, one Hexier up in a disaster zone. Right? This is success. I'm on schedule.